Hi, I'm Yudi Bunyamin, and welcome to The Neumann Talk, a podcast where I meet past winners of the Australian Mathematical Society's B.H. Neumann Prize to learn about their journeys through the world of mathematics. This episode's guest is Dr. Matthew Tam, who is currently a lecturer in the School of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Melbourne. Prior to joining the University of Melbourne, Matt was a postdoctoral researcher and then a junior professor at the University of Göttingen in Germany. Matt's research lies mainly in a branch of mathematics known as optimization. In 2018, his paper in the ANSIEM Journal was awarded the Mahoney-Neumann-Room Prize for outstanding contributions to the Australian Mathematical Society's research publications. Matt jointly won the B.H. Neumann Prize in 2015 while he was a PhD student at the University of Newcastle, working under the supervision of the late Jonathan Borwein. So what do you remember of your Neumann Prize winning talk, Matt?
To be honest, I remember the room that, so it was in the optimization special session at the conference, but the rest of the details are a little bit blurry to me. I can remember what the talk was about. And I can remember that it was at Flinders University, towards the end of my PhD. It was the last OSMF conference I attended as a PhD student. And I remember that Terence Tao gave the public lecture at that conference as well, being a Flinders alumni. But I have to say that I don't remember too much about the actual experience of giving the talk in hindsight. Maybe I can say something briefly about what the talk was about, though. So I am an optimizer, I would say. So I work in mathematical optimization. And what my talk was about was about optimization algorithms for reconstructing images in something that's called tichographic imaging. So roughly what this means is, imagine you have some specimen, and when I say specimen, I'm thinking about something like a nanotube or a protein or some kind of crystal, something that's small that you can't see with your eyes. And what you do is you fire some kind of beam into that specimen, and that beam could be x-rays, it could be electrons, and it depends on this experimental setup, but mathematically all the problems are the same. And what you record then is you have a kind of detector on the other side of your specimen, and that detects a diffraction pattern as this beam of whatever it is hits your specimen. So you get a kind of diffraction pattern, and what you want to try and do is reconstruct the specimen from this diffraction pattern. It doesn't look exactly like the specimen. And there's actually not even enough information in the specimen in the diffraction pattern to completely and uniquely reconstruct your specimen. So it's a very ill-posed problem. That's kind of the types of problems that we were looking at there. And it actually gets even more complicated because suppose you wanted to make a high-quality picture of your specimen. Right? So what could you do? Well, one thing you can do is you can get a better camera with high resolution. But of course, that only works up to a point, right? At some point, it's no longer feasible to keep building better and better real resolution cameras. And so what you can do instead is you zoom your camera in onto some small part of that specimen that you're trying to take a picture of, and you can take a high quality photo, if you like, of that small region of that specimen. But you now don't have the whole specimen in that image. So what you do is a bit like when you take a panorama with your smartphone, you take a heap of different pictures that are zoomed in, and then you have to try and stitch them together afterwards. The difference here is that you're not stitching together these pictures directly, but you are stitching them together from a series of diffraction patterns. And so what my talk was about a optimization approach to reconstructing this image of whatever you're trying to look at from these diffraction patterns.
So this sounds like the kind of talk that has lots of pretty pictures in it.
So yeah, there was definitely pictures in it. That's one of the, I guess, the nice things when you're giving a talk or you're speaking about a topic that has something to do with image reconstruction or reconstruction of some kind of image, that you can, you know, include those into the talk, and it's a very visual way to see something's working or something's not working. So I can remember, for instance, in my talk, I showed the reconstruction of these sort of images in part of the talk. So there was kind of like a little video where, you know, it shows what you think it looks like before you run the algorithm. And these algorithms, the way they work is they generate a sequence of approximate reconstructions, where each one is kind of getting better and better and better. So in the talk, what I think I had a video that sort of showed how the reconstruction got better and better as the algorithm is run for longer and longer.
Do you think that you had an advantage because of that? Like, do you think that's a contributing factor to why you won? Or why do you think you won?
I mean, there were many great talks at the at OSMS conference, and there always is. So I don't know that I could necessarily say why my talk was chosen or not. I certainly think that having pictures can be helpful in those situations, but I think that pictures on their own are not necessarily everything. So I also remember in my talk that I sort of explained the derivation of the algorithm I was doing in a way that I kind of built it up from something that, you know, you might try and use in the first instance, and then went through a series of modifications to get to an algorithm that would actually work. And perhaps from the mathematical side, building up in that stepwise fashion where you explain each of the steps of how you get from what you might try without thinking about this problem seriously to what you actually should try when you're actually trying to do it. Maybe that was also part. So maybe the combination of pictures didn't hurt, but also some interesting mathematics as well. I think this kind of is something that I kind of like my mathematical philosophy more generally. So there's kind of an interplay between, you know, what's the interesting mathematical theory and how that mathematical theory is developed and can inform what you want to do when you're trying to solve problems and looking at particular applications. So that's kind of from theory to applications, but then the other way as well, right? So starting off with applications and using those to guide you so you know what sort of theory you should be trying to develop or what things you think should work but don't know yet.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get to talk a lot more about the maths that you do. But, I mean, you're going to be organizing the optimization special session at the OSTMS meeting in 2020. And, I mean, you've been heavily involved in a lot of service, like organizing conferences, and you've definitely been to many OSTMSs in your career. But I'm always curious, something that I'm always curious about with Neumann winners, which I probably am going to go through myself now, is since winning the prize, did you ever feel pressure that, like, you're not allowed to give a bad talk anymore now, especially at the OSTMS?
So I would say that any pressure on me to give a good or bad talk or a good talk in this case is probably coming from within. So it's, I don't feel like there's such pressure from the OSMS or from colleagues, but it's more about, you know, I like to try and give good talks whenever I can. So probably in that sense, most of the pressure is coming from myself. Maybe you also feel the same to some extent.
Yeah, I somehow, as much pressure as I feel now, I somehow am fully aware that it's just coming from within. So you did your bachelor's degree at the University of Newcastle, but I don't know if this is like a commonly known thing about you amongst your colleagues, but it wasn't just in mathematics. It was in chemistry as well.
Yeah, that's right.
So why chemistry and what happened to the chemistry?
Yeah. So if I think about when I started university, in high school, I was pretty good at maths and science subjects. And so at the time, it felt kind of natural to enroll in a degree that was related to mathematics and science. In my first year, I did mathematics, physics, and chemistry. And I found at the time I thought physics was interesting, but it was too difficult though, in the sense that at the time I was doing physics then in first year, I felt like I didn't have the mathematical background to understand what was being taught in physics. And that kind of frustrated me at the time. So after first year, physics disappeared and I did mathematics and chemistry. I sort of realized maybe that second year that I was more interested in the mathematics than in chemistry. And so from then on, I finished, degrees in both areas, but never had any intention really to continue to pursue chemistry after the bachelor degree. So it was kind of, if you like, a process of slow elimination as I went off through the years.
Yeah, I think with the advent of degrees that have specialized in mathematics from the beginning, like, for example, Bachelor of Advanced Maths that we have at UNSW, and it's similar equivalents in many places. Like, less common to find people who didn't know that of the sciences, maths was what they wanted to do from the onset. Like, you have less people who go by process of elimination. And if anything, they do double degrees from different faculties. They say maths and business, right? And then the process of the choice is between these two in, you know, very contrasting things. So, you know, you did a couple of different things during your undergrad, including a summer vacation research program, and you know, you did honors in the area of maths that you kind of work in now, right? So somewhere in that journey, you probably started leaning towards, you know, what we would traditionally associate with as applied mathematics. How did that happen?
So you're right, I did do a few vacation scholarships. The first one I did was in capacitated lot sizing, which is an optimization problem. So, but not from the type of optimization I do now, but from more of a discrete combinatorial optimization focus. So that was probably the first time that I had a insight into what it might be like to do research in optimization and in mathematics. Then after that, I did another vacation project with my PhD advisor, Jonathan Boyne. And that was actually not in optimization at all, but that was in number theory. So something completely, completely different. But that was kind of the first connection that I had with him. He did many things, he did from analysis to optimization to number theory to experimental mathematics. And then after that, I did another project with him that was essentially in the same area as my honors thesis. So I guess that's kind of it was clear to me that I was interested in optimization. And then I guess there's the question about what sort of optimization are you interested in? And I guess at the time I decided I was more interested in continuous optimization.
There are some people who can like talk for days on end about why they fell in love with the area of maths that they're working on. And then there's some people who just go, well, I just liked it. So would you classify yourself as the second, you know, group?
I guess so. Yeah, I just liked it. I think that in mathematical optimization, you often have this situation, right, where you try and develop some algorithm to solve a problem. So you have the development side of the algorithm you get to see. There's the theoretical side where you try and prove or show that this algorithm always works. So, or you try and analyze it. But then there's also the kind of practical application side where you're taking problems from the world and you are actually implementing that algorithm and you're seeing, you know, how many seconds does it take to solve this problem? How does that compare to another method that you apply? And I think probably what I like about optimization is that you get to see sort of the whole process from, you know, something that is maybe theoretical mathematics on one hand, right through to taking it to a point where you're actually, you know, getting a number out of a computer.
So then at some point you decided you wanted to do a PhD, also with Jonathan. I guess, am I right in saying that when you first signed up to do your undergrad, you didn't imagine that you would be doing a PhD in maths?
Yeah, that That would be correct. I would say probably I didn't even really understand fully what it meant to do a PhD.
So what changed?
So I guess even after I finished my honors, I thought of it as an option, but I still wasn't sure that's what I wanted to do. So I remember after I finished honors, I was also applying for lots of different graduate programs. And one of those was with the CSIRO. They have I don't know if they still have it, but they have a sort of a short kind of graduate program, a few years sort of fixed term, working on projects. And I applied for that. And I got to, as part of that process, I got to see some of how the CSIRO was working. And it all seemed really interesting and exciting to me, but there always seemed to be something holding back that if you wanted to work at a place like that long term, it was that you needed to have a PhD to work there. So that was kind of the moment that I decided to do a PhD, I think, when I was considering these other options, but then thought, you know, maybe if I wanted to pursue those, I might need a PhD anyway.
So Jonathan was one of the most well-respected mathematicians in Australia. And everyone we've spoken to, when we've told them, like, oh, we're going to interview Matt, they've all said that I'm sure he has lots of great stories to tell about working with Jonathan. So on behalf of a lot of people, I'm now putting that question forward. What was it like working with him?
So it was, certainly very interesting. He obviously had many connections with different people around the world. So you also got to meet lots of interesting people when you were working with him. Sometimes a little bit chaotic, I would say, in the sense that you always felt like his brain was working 10 times faster than yours. You would talk to him and he would say something and you'd go, oh, okay. And then you'd go back to your office and then think, no, I don't know what he was talking about. And then 2 weeks later, you would go, oh, okay, I see now. But I think probably one other thing that was nice working with him is that, because I said before, like he worked in many different kind of areas, of mathematics, you also got to see some of those things as well. So I remember like at the time that I was at Newcastle, Fran Aragon, who was one of his postdocs at the time, drew a random walk based on the digits of pi, I forget how many digits or something like that. But, that's something that doesn't fall within optimization, but something that I got to see and kind of, feel like I was kind of, experiencing that at the same time that I was working on it as well. So seeing some of those different projects that different people were working on was probably one of the interesting things. Yeah.
But, I mean, your work now is quite specialized. I mean, you're not like Jonathan where you dabble in number theory and lots of other different things. So I guess he never really coerced you into being so broad in your research interests in it. Or do you feel like he had a huge influence on your deciding to stay in optimization?
I would say that, I work in optimization, but certainly some of the work that I do is very strongly influenced by what I had seen with him. So for instance, one of the tools of optimization is convex analysis. And John was interested in experimental mathematics and where those two things kind of, so usually when people think about experimental mathematics, the traditional problems that people can attack with it are, you have some identity involving special functions or mathematical constants or something like that. And you can try and verify or prove these things using computer algebra or, high precision arithmetic. But one of the things I'm interested in now is what you would call symbolic convex analysis or, computer assisted proof, but their uses in optimization. So in symbolic convex analysis, for instance, what you would do is if you all of us has probably seen something like Wolfram Alpha or, Maple Mathematica Sage, where you can say to it, what's the derivative of this function or what's the integral of this function or something like that. Symbolic convex analysis is the same sort of thing, but in the convex analysis world. So In convex analysis, you want to do different operations, like compute something called the convex conjugate of a function, or sub-differentiate a function, or various things like that. So certainly those areas, I think, have very strong influence from Jordan.
So I understand that after your PhD, you spent some time in Germany doing research. Do you have any fond memories of that?
So there are a few things that are kind of interesting from the student perspective, at least. So this is not something that applies at all places in Germany, but at least at the university I was at, which is the University of Göttingen, they had some pretty interesting traditions. So for instance, there's a statue in the middle of the town called the Ganzer Liesel. And when a PhD student graduates in Göttingen, their advisors pull them in a wooden cart from the graduation ceremony to this statue. So the advisor pulls them, and then when they get there, they have to climb the statue and put flowers in her hair. So that's kind of interesting.
I know you've talked a lot about your research, like bits and pieces of research, but maybe this is a good time for me to put forward the question I've asked everyone. And I like to phrase it this way, which is, if I were at a pub speaking to a random person and they asked me, what does Matt do? Like, what's his research about? What should I tell them?
So I would say he works in mathematical optimization, which, roughly speaking, is the field of mathematics that likes to minimize or maximize some quantity expressed as a mathematical function, I guess, subject to some restrictions on the decisions you're allowed to make in order to change that quantity or influence that quantity. And the particular type of optimization that he works in is continuous optimization. So that's where the decisions that you make are allowed to take any range of values in a given interval or something like that, as opposed to just the integers or binary variables or something.
So when you put it like that, I think it sounds like, okay, that's maths, right? But like when you were describing to me what was in your Neumann talk, I think even if I'm like doing a PhD in math now, I still wonder, like, where's the maths in that?
Right,
because you're talking about images and stuff like that. And
so, yeah, that's a good question, right? So this is highlighting one thing, right? So there's a physical problem. We need a mathematical model to describe it, to bring that into the language of mathematics. And then once we have that model, we can use the tools of mathematics and mathematical optimization to deal with it. So I guess in the way that this problem is modeled, the object that you are trying to reconstruct, or the specimen, you can think of that like a kind of matrix. So, you know, like a square that has a whole heap of entries in it that you're trying to reconstruct the pixel values, if you like. And the way that you model this problem in order to solve it as an optimization problem is you try to minimize the difference between your current guess of what this specimen looks like, so your current approximation. You minimize the distance between that and the diffraction pattern that would result if you knew that. So if you know what the specimen is, you can compute what the diffraction pattern would be, but you can't undo this process, which the undoing bit is the hard bit. So what you do is you minimize the function that measures the distance or the discrepancy between your current guess of the specimen and what its diffraction pattern would be to what the actual experimentally observed diffraction pattern is.
I'm dabbling in optimization for the first time at the moment because we've recently sort of started to have a feeling that my research is going in that direction, right? And being a stats major in undergrad, like it's not really something that I've seen before. Like I'm currently doing an optimization course. And what I'm starting to realize is that the ideas are actually not the most, you know, unintuitive things in the world, but the area is quite abstract. And I mean, optimization is a word that you can say to a random person and it makes some sense. It's not like if I say to them topology, right? Like it may not make sense to someone who doesn't have a mathematical background. I guess my question is, like, you know, because we see a bit of optimization in high school, right? With, you know, we take the derivative function and find the minimum and the maximum value. Like, how far away is what you're doing from the kind of things that we get to see in high school?
So in some sense, it's not that far away. So what's the difference? In high school, when we want to find the minimum or maximum of a function and we differentiate to find the points where the derivative is equal to zero, right? That's a process that we can do entirely on paper. We can write it down and we can compute all these things by hand. So that's good, but it turns out that sometimes these things cannot be computed by hand, or sometimes the expressions for the function that we're trying to maximize or minimize isn't so simple that we could even compute it by hand, even if we were given an unlimited amount of time. And so I guess the difference between what you would do in high school with that sort of procedure there versus what I'm doing is we are developing methods that find the point where the derivative would be zero, but they do it in a way that kind of is algorithmic. So there's a recipe that says, if you just want to find out what the point is, then you do this recipe. And if you run enough steps of this recipe, you approximate what that point would be. So there's also an approximation step in there as well. But yeah, the difference is we can't do this with pen and paper, so we need a computer to do it. When you want a computer to do something, you have to tell the computer how to do it. And the mathematics that I'm doing is about what the computer should do and figuring out how it should do it in a way that we can be certain that it will always work for some problems, at least.
So that sounds very mathematical again. I mean, it's not just you, but like a lot of applied mathematicians I talk to, like, you can have long stretches of time where you wonder, where's the maths in this? And a long stretch of time where it's just all math, right? When I was much younger, I remember there was a period of time in my childhood when if people asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, it was applied mathematician. For absolutely no good reason, probably. And there's probably no good reason why I always stuck the word applied in front of it. Other than maybe I felt like, well, I wanted to do good for the world, right? I didn't want to, I guess a lot of people have this impression that pure mathematicians don't really do anything useful, right? Do you think that we, the general population, has a good understanding of what applied maths really is?
So I think it's, applied maths is also not something that's just set in stone, right? So there are degrees of applied mathematics, like in terms of, you know, super, very applied to more theoretical ends. The first thing I want to say is that it's not an absolute term, like, you know, satisfy these three things, you're an applied mathematician, otherwise you're a pure mathematician. So I guess that makes it more difficult, first of all, because it's not such a precise term. But I think that the idea that only applied mathematicians are doing interesting things for the real world is also not completely fair either. Maybe it is difficult. It's even difficult for me to try and, you know, explain the exact difference as well. So probably it is hard for the general public then.
Yeah. One thing I've sort of realized, not just doing this podcast, but doing a lot of like outreach work, and particularly the outreach work that led to, you know, my Neumann Prize, was that there are a lot of open problems in maths communication. Just like there are a lot of open problems in pure mathematics or applied mathematics or whatever. And yeah, I mean, every year, you know, in every maths department, we probably get together all our undergrads and do a session on, oh, which major to choose, pure applied or stats, right? But I guess we, you know, it's either you accept that the truth is that the lines are blurred, or like we just still haven't figured out how to properly explain to someone what the difference is.
I guess in the general population as well, it's also the awareness of what it actually means to be a mathematician, period. Any type of mathematician is also, people are not always aware what it means to be a mathematician. I'm sure that plenty of people have said this too, that when people hear that you work in mathematics, one of the first questions is, oh, so you're a teacher. So you're a mathematics teacher at a school. And so, I mean, maybe one of the reasons why that is because it's a job that has the word mathematics in the title. It's very easy to match those two things up from that. And many other jobs that have something to do with mathematics don't necessarily have that in the title. Perhaps that's part of the difficulty there.
I think maybe, and I don't know if this is a fantasy or if there's some truth in it, or at least I have this fantasy of like applied mathematicians are actually saving the world. Like they're publishing papers and then 3 weeks later it's, you know, curing someone's disease. Like, I mean, how accurate is that?
So I guess, so one thing that we've seen right now is that with coronavirus, we've seen at least a much more visible, we've seen much greater visibility of mathematicians working in epidemiology, for instance, right? So that's certainly a case where we can see very direct impacts from mathematics, and maybe saving the world in 3 weeks is a bit of a stretch, but certainly they're making a difference in 3 weeks or less. So it can happen in the right conditions, I guess. But it's also, we should not be so short-sighted as to only look at mathematics that we think might be useful for us in 3 weeks' time or in 6 months' time or things like that, even in applied mathematics. You know, if we had not already done, in the case of the coronavirus, all this epidemiological modeling and mathematical modeling, we wouldn't be able to call on that and use that right now. So although it's mobilized now, it's actually been a long time in the making, as is the case with many other areas of mathematics.
That's something I actually relate to a little bit, because I, even though what I work on is traditionally considered as pure maths, even though I don't feel that way about it, but since the coronavirus, and there's been some talk about issues with testing, I mean, without going into too much of the details, and basically there've been a lot of, I've been to a lot of seminars these days where what they're really saying is, you design theorists like didn't work out all the issues before coronavirus happened, and hence, you know, we weren't able to make testing better, right? So you better get a move on before the next pandemic. I guess I see what you mean. And I guess that's not just an applied maths thing. You know, like that's quite universal in mathematics, is like this idea of, you know, we can't just work on problems just because we see the applications right away. Do you personally work on problems which you see the applications right away? Like, do you have a preference?
I wouldn't necessarily say that I have a preference. I think I dabble a bit on both sides of them. So, you know, sometimes I'll start with the application and then try and work back to theory. Sometimes I'll start with the theory and then go looking at the application. So I wouldn't say I have a preference. And I think, yeah, being able to do in both directions makes it more exciting too.
So how do you find interesting problems in optimization for which you don't see the applications yet?
So sometimes it can be a matter of, you know, you're working on something new theoretically, let's say. So you're working on a new algorithm and you can build it in a way that it has a certain feature, which might be novel. So for whatever reason, this particular feature makes it, you realize that this feature would be really useful if there was a problem that had a certain property. And so then you can go looking for problems that have this particular property. So like one example of that that came up recently was, so we had developed an algorithm that could solve a particular type of problem. And then what we found was there was, and the way that this algorithm worked, it was not relying on any smoothness of the functions involved. So they didn't have to be smooth differentiable functions. They could be non-differential. And so but then we found that there was a certain problem arising in partial differential equations whose solution was not smooth. And so we were able to connect these two because now we had an algorithm that could work with these non-smooth things. And we could then now apply that to this differential equations problem that didn't have a smooth solution. But that was okay because we could combine those two things together. So That's, for instance, one example.
I want to bring up something you said quite a while ago now on the podcast. You mentioned experimental mathematics. Now, we don't really do experiments in the class, in the maths classroom in school, or even like in university. I don't think we ever use that term. That's something we associate with other sciences. So what is experimental math?
So experimental mathematics is a kind of, well, in some sense, it's a philosophy, I like to think of it as, where you are often using a computer as a tool, where you use the computer to try and rapidly produce evidence for some conjecture that you're trying to prove, or something that you think is true, or try and disprove something. So, you know, in a typical example, you might, in optimization, for instance, where I might be using this, right? So I might be developing a new algorithm, and I might think, this algorithm works, I think. Could I try and show something mathematically that says, prove a theorem that says this algorithm works for this class of problems? So then what I would do is I would, before trying to prove that mathematically, which might be very difficult and it might be false, right? I would go to the computer, I would program it up, I would try the algorithm in a whole heap of different problems. And if it worked for all those problems, that would be evidence to say, this algorithm probably works. If it didn't work all the time, that would say, probably this is not going to work. Don't try and pursue this any further. So it's kind of, the rapid testing part is one part of it, and then also helping to guide you about what mathematics you would do with pen and paper.
So I think both of us aren't old enough to experience a time when computers were not as powerful as they are today. And sometimes when I'm teaching first year maths, you know, like it dawns on me like, oh, these students are young enough that they've never seen a floppy disk before. Things like that. And another thing that's really surprised me is how more mathematicians than I realize use computers in their research. Do you think it's changed a lot, or has that always been a thing, especially in your area?
Yeah, I do think it's changed a lot from whatever the traditional model of a mathematician was some time ago. So I think that, most people, regardless of their area, are using computers in some part of their research. I think, it's more like, so I guess my PhD advisor, John Bowen, would have said that it's like the computer is your collaborator, if you like. So you're good at doing one type of thing, your computer is good at doing something else, namely, if you give it a set of instructions, it'll give you the answer and it'll probably do it accurately. And so you have slightly different skill sets and you're able to leverage those two things together. So it's like having an extra collaborator all the time.
And do you think the landscape of research and optimization is going to change really drastically in the future because of this?
Yeah, well, I think we have already seen some drastic changes in the type of optimization that's been done as a consequence of this. So, the types of problems you want to solve and the features of those problems determine what sort of optimization tools you can apply to them. So, for instance, in more recent times, in machine learning, people are using neural networks for a whole range of different problems. And when you train a neural network, so that before you actually can deploy it and use it, you have to train it. That training step uses mathematical optimization. And when you're doing that training step, you have a huge data set that you're training the network on. And it's actually so huge that you can't run your full algorithm. It just would take too long. So you have to do a stochastic version of the algorithm. So stochastic gradient descent would be this sort of base algorithm you would use there. And so that the fact that you need that sort of thing there is sort of guiding a whole area of research and optimization where you're looking at different stochastic versions of algorithms which you can apply. Now, if you didn't have those huge problems, then you might not be interested in pursuing stochastic variants of those algorithms. So I think we're already seeing the interplay between those two things.
So like I mentioned, you know, optimization is something that most people have some grasp of, like even in day-to-day life. Do you find that since you've dived into optimization, that it's affected things you do in your day-to-day life? Like, are you a more efficient person than you were before you discovered optimization?
I would say no, but maybe some other people would tell me yes.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of question that you should ask people around you, actually. But
I'm definitely a kind of greedy optimizer when I can be. So in the sense that, like, greedy algorithms make the best decision based on the options that you have at a single point in time in front of you without thinking about what the consequences might be later on. I definitely do some greedy optimization, but probably we all do that naturally as well.
Do you have an example of that in, like, your day-to-day life?
Yeah, sure. So say I'm driving towards a traffic light, and as I approach the traffic light, the straight ahead direction changes to red, but the turning right lane turns to green. Then I might quickly change and turn because I think I'm going to get there quicker. So,
I mean, optimization in the form that you describe is not something we really see much in school or even as an undergrad if you don't pursue, you know, that route. Do you think there are aspects of optimization that we should introduce to, say, kids at an earlier age?
Yeah, well, I think that there are probably some elements of optimization in disguise that we see at an earlier age. So, I mean, we talked earlier about, so we're thinking about high school. We talked earlier about, you know, minimizing or maximizing a function by using calculus. And that's kind of the, you know, the classical example. But we also, at least in when I went to high school in New South Wales, I saw algorithms for finding a root of a function. So like one of them was, the bisection method, right? So you want to find where the function crosses the x-axis, so the x-intercept, and you choose two points. The function's positive at one point and negative at the other point. So you know that somewhere in between those two things, it has to cross the x-axis. And then you halve the interval and you check the intervals and you proceed like that, right? And then I also remember seeing Newton's method in high school as well. So, you know, does the same sort of thing, but using a more sophisticated method. Both of these things can be used in optimization as well. They form the basis of optimization algorithms. Just the difference is when you're talking about finding a root of a function, right, what you're really doing is the same as when you differentiate a function and you try and find the points where the derivative is zero. It's just that instead of applying it to the function, you're applying it to the derivative of the function. So we do see some of those algorithms, but maybe you just don't think about them in an optimization sense.
Talking about maths more generally, why math? What do you think is keeping you in math?
I mean, you often hear that people describe when you, maybe it's not something purely about math, but it's when you figure out something new in mathematics or, you know, in optimization, that could also, you could mean you're finding a new algorithm, or it could mean you got some really great computational results that really improved on what was done previously. You know, you get a kind of rush, right? It's a bit like, some people describe it as kind of like a drug. So there's kind of certainly that sort of aspect. But there's also the fact that you can really be pretty creative, right? So it's, people like to think of mathematics as not creative in the same sense as, you know, the arts, for instance, right? But really, I think it is just as creative, you know? You're talking about trying to design things or trying to find patterns in things and seeing those things, there's some degree of creativity there as well. So I also enjoy that aspect as well. I'm not sure that I'll be able to have that same sort of thing in working in other jobs. Yeah, maybe the one other thing is that it's also the case that, you know, I've traveled to different conferences around the world and stuff. And it's, you do feel like no matter where you are in the world, if you're in a maths department, there is kind of a feeling that, you know, the mathematics you speak when you're sitting in your department in Australia or in my case in Melbourne is the same as if I go to another country and start talking to someone. There's some kind of universality of that as well, which is also something that's really nice. You don't have that in all areas, even at a university. For instance, in areas like public health, right? Public health is very country-centric. So that universal language can break down when you start to change between countries, for instance.
The phrase that maths is a universal language or maths is a language is something that gets thrown out a lot, but I don't think people actually understand what we mean by that. What do you think we mean by that?
So I really think that my feeling from, going anywhere in the world and you start to talk to someone, another mathematician, about mathematics, and you both know exactly what you are talking about. So there's kind of like a shared, maybe I'm a bit hesitant to use the word language there, but there's kind of like a shared understanding of everything. It doesn't change when, the mathematics that gets done in Australia and the mathematics that gets done in Germany, at the end of the day, it's mathematics, they're the same thing.
So that leads me to ask a question that we ask all of our guests at the end of the episode, which is to complete the sentence, a mathematician is someone who?
A mathematician is someone who makes intuition precise. So I feel like that a lot of mathematics is, you have some intuitive idea or some intuitive feeling of how something is either working or what something is. And taking this intuitive idea and making it into a precise statement, precise, unambiguous statement is what mathematics are, I think.
Very special thanks to Matthew Tam for taking the time to chat with us. You can find out more about Matt by visiting his website linked in the show notes. This episode was produced by Alina Sari and myself. We'll be back next week with another interview. Neumann Talk is a podcast produced by students and staff from the School of Mathematics and Statistics at UNSW Sydney and hosted by me, Yudi Bunyamin. Follow UNSW Maths and Stats on Facebook or Instagram to see updates on the latest episodes as well as other exciting news from our school. If you've been listening to our podcast, then we'd love to hear from you. Send me a tweet or a message on Twitter at Yudi_Bunyamin. Let us know who you are and if there's something one of the winners talked about that really resonated with you, or even if you have any questions about mathematics of your own.